Well, hello, friends. This is John Noyes filling in today for my boss and mentor, Greg Kokel at Stand to Reason. And boy, is this a very interesting time to be joining you today. And man, I got a lot to say. I'm happy to be able to spend some time with you. And up front, I also want to just make sure that you get through on the lines. If you want to give us a call, you can do so. Our number here in the studio is 855-243-9975. And we're live from 4 to 6 today. And now, when I say today, I want to make sure you guys know it's Tuesday, June 2nd. So if you find yourself listening live, call that number, 855-243-9975. And I'd love to address some of your questions. While I'm not Greg Kokel, we can still have some fun together. And if you find yourself in international waters, if you are overseas and would like to call in, that number is going to be 1-562-424-8229. And actually, did you guys know that there's another way that you can get your questions to us? If you don't want to call in right away, that's fine. You can tweet your questions to hashtag STRask. Now, there's no S at the end of that. Make sure you get that right. Hashtag STRask, and you'll get through to that question will get through to Amy and Greg, and they'll answer it on our STRask podcast. And every Monday and Thursday, we drop new episodes on iTunes or whatever you use for your podcasting pleasure. Or you can actually listen to it on the STR app. So with that, those formalities, I'd really love to, just spend some time with you guys thinking about the culture at large and what we're facing right now, you know. And I'd like to start off just kind of a little bit of, I'm actually kind of in a heightened mood today, because this weekend, the church that I help lead actually got to meet, and I got to actually preach the sermon. And when I was reading and preparing for my sermon out of John 13, I was speaking on Pentecost, and a verse really popped out at me and got me. And I don't know if that's ever happened to you guys when you're reading the Bible and studying it. Something really jumps out at you that you've read 1,000 times before, but stands out in a special way. And I'm talking about John 13, 34 through 35. And I'm going to read in a second, but I think that the principle here, the new commandment, as it were, that Jesus lays down for us, can help guide us into the cultural conversation that's going on all around us. Like, we find ourselves right now, your listening ears, I know they find us in maybe some heavy times. Maybe you're wrestling with the current events that are going on around you, whether it be Mr. Floyd or whether it be the pandemic or both of them combined. Let these words sink in, and then I'm going to walk us through them and maybe just give you some of my thoughts. And then at the break, after it, we can get some of your thoughts. I'd love to hear from you. So in John 13, 34 and 35, Jesus says this. He says, "A new commandment I gave to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this, all men will know that you're my disciples, if you've loved one another." These words for me right away brought back to my mind The Mark of the Christian by Francis Schaeffer. In that book about this very passage, he says, this passage reveals the mark that Jesus gives to label a Christian, not just in one area or era, but in all locality and at all times, in all places, until Jesus returns. C.S. Lewis wrote this: "Love is not an affectionate feeling, but a steady wish for the loved person's ultimate good, as far as it can be obtained," is what Lewis says. You see, in times of turmoil, times of trouble, times of sadness, and even anger, love, I think, I mean, and I'm talking like Christian love, the love of Jesus, is really what breaks everything down. I think it breaks tensions down. I think it breaks, I'm thinking of the COVID-19 situation. I'm in my house right now, staring at my computer screen, hoping that my four daughters and my wife are able to not make a peep. And we've been, I feel like, locked up. But it's when I hit this verse, and this new commandment that Jesus gave, for some reason, my soul was lifted up. And I want to talk a little bit about this. You know, Paul writes, he says that if I speak with tongues of men and angels, but don't have love, I've become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but I don't have love, I'm nothing, is what Paul says. And if I give all my possessions to feed the poor, and if I surrender my body to be burned, but I don't have love, it profits me nothing. And then thinking about, you know, this new commandment that Jesus gives us, love is central to the message that we have. And I feel like as we move towards the culture and speak to the major issues of the day, I think we need to do so in love. You see, Jesus here in the new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. Jesus is speaking, we need to understand, directly to his disciples. He's telling them blatantly that he's leaving them, right? So this is in the Upper Room Discourse, and he's about to leave. He's about to go to the cross. In just a few hours, he's going to be arrested, and he knows this, and he's preparing his disciples, and he tells them that I'm going to be leaving. He follows this by giving them this new commandment that should be heeded ultimately, and by extension, all Christians. And that commandment is super clear to us, and it's that we got to love each other. But let's also remember that we're called to love all men. We're called to love even our enemies. You see, the love used in our John verse here is agape love. And if you've been following Stand to Reason and you dig into your Bible, you know what agape love means. It's self-sacrificial love. And it's the greatest kind of love. You know, this is the same love that God talks about when we hear in John 3:16, for God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten son. And this is a perfect example of agape love in Jesus. It's selfless, self-sacrificial in its very nature, and hoping for nothing in return. It's also the same love used in Matthew 5:43. And moving forward through that passage, you've heard that it was said that you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemies. Now listen to this. I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. And I'm hoping that by now you're picking up kind of like where I'm going with this commentary today. You know, the command to love seemingly applies to all people, just as it does our brothers and sisters in Christ. We're to agape all people. And in full disclosure to you guys, as I'm sitting here right now, I gotta be honest. I am a skeptic at heart. So I ask a lot of questions. I never take anything on face value. I don't have all the answers. That's Greg. Greg has all the answers, I think. I don't have the answers to a lot of stuff. So I ask a lot of questions. And right here, when I'm reading this passage and this weekend preparing for my sermon, and even in the days leading up to this time right here, I have a huge glaring why question in my mind. Why are we to love people? And when I say love, like we just said, this isn't just normal love. This is agape love. This is we're being told to love all people as Jesus loved. Why love all people regardless of race, ethnicity, religion, political affiliation, in the same way that we do each other? And when I say each other, those of us who claim the name of Christ, you know, the answer here to that question, though, I call it the great equalizer. And I really want you to listen close, guys, because this is so important. And I'm so passionate about this because when I look at the world around me and where we find ourselves in these current times, you know, the answer is this. You see, we love everybody not because of the color of our skin, not because of our political affiliation, not because of our religion. We love each other because we're all made in the image of God, the Imago Dei. And it's there that we find our value, our worth, its inherent meaning. It can't ever be taken from us. There's nothing that can change that. We're not valuable because we're redeemed. We're valuable because we're made in the image of God. We're his image bearers. And I want that to sink in, because what I mean by saying that, when I say that we're not valuable because we're redeemed, that means if you're listening right now and you're a Christian, you're redeemed. And if you're not a Christian, then we have some work to do. But this is important because you still bear the image of God. You know, the non-Christian is just as much made in the Creator's image as are the Christians. So they're therefore just as valuable in the economy of God. Just because someone rejects this too, and keep this in mind, just because someone rejects this fact doesn't make it any less true. You see, we live in the world that God created. We live in the world that was set up by God according to His laws and His rules. So even if you don't believe that, even if you reject the truth, it's still true. We're made in the image of God. And just because someone rejects Christ, being in Christ, we ought to know the true value of all people. You know, Jesus taught that we're all neighbors. I mean, this is the whole point of the parable of the Good Samaritan. We are all neighbors. And as such, we as Christians are to love everyone as if that's true, as if that's really true. When I say true, it accurately reflects reality the way things really are. We're to do this on the basis of creation alone, not on the basis of whether someone is redeemed or not, not on the basis of whether somebody is black or white, not on the basis of whether somebody is a Hindu, a Muslim, a Christian, a Jew. We do this to all people because all people are made in the image of God and they ought to be loved. And they ought to be loved in an agape sense, even at great cost. And I think we desperately need to hear this message today. I think we really need to hear this. Right now, as I'm speaking to you, we need to hear this and we need to heed the words. And while this passage is speaking of a disciple's relationship with other disciples, Jesus is talking to his disciples. It doesn't negate Jesus' other teaching regarding love, which are equally as radical. We're not called to love our enemies one way, but our fellow Christians another, is what I'm saying to you guys. You know, Jesus commands us to love all people equally. Jesus' commandments reinforce each other. Now, with the next few minutes before we get to our first break and hopefully some of your calls, I'd like just to kind of break this down just a little bit for you, and because I think this love that we're going to talk about, and this is transformative love, guys. This is love that can make a real difference in somebody's life. It does make real. It did in mine. It did in yours, maybe. But it manifests itself in three separate ways in this verse. And I think it's really interesting in these two verses, rather. You know, I think this love that we're talking about, it demonstrates obedience when we practice it. You know, it also exemplifies Christ when we copy Christ and do as he did. But even more than that, it bears witness. In verse 34, it says this. It says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another." In the Master Plan of Evangelism, Robert Coleman writes this. He says, "Perfection of love is now the only standard of conduct. And this love was to manifest itself in obedience to Christ expressed in devotion to those whom he died to save. There was a cross in it. The willing denial of self for others." Friends, this is the kind of love I'm talking about. When we love one another like this, we demonstrate our obedience to God. And not everyone can handle this, by the way. It's a hard thing. And that's why we're told to count the costs of our obedience. You know, but nevertheless, Jesus constantly associates our love for him with our obedience to God. Even though it's hard, we're still called to do it. You guys get what I'm saying? Even though something's hard, and even though, and this is important, even though it's almost impossible to do, it is impossible to do this side of heaven, to love perfectly, it doesn't mean that's not the example that we strive for. That's the target that we shoot for. You know, and this is attested to, the importance of this, I think, is attested to by the sheer number of times Jesus reiterates this over and again. If you love me, keep my commandments. You know, it's he who keeps my commandments and knows my commands and keeps them. It's he who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him manifest himself to him. That's John 14:21. You know, John writes about love all over the place. If you keep my commandments, you'll abide in my love, John 15. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friend. You're my friend if you do whatever I command, John 15:12. through 15. You see, friends, right now, I think more than maybe ever, more than at least in recent memory, we got to take these things seriously. I ask myself again, I'm critical of myself and I'm guilty of so many things. And I ask myself, how am I loving my neighbor? You know, how am I loving compared to Christ's love? You know, am I willing to become so obedient as to agape, not just my Christian brothers and sisters, not just those people I got to hang out with this past Sunday, which lifted my spirits, but am I willing to do it to my unbelieving neighbor who perhaps has a lifestyle I don't agree with, you know, but I know he doesn't know the Lord. So maybe he needs that kind of love, because the way that we love these people demonstrates our loyalty and our obedience to God. You see, we're followers of Jesus Christ. And as being followers of Jesus Christ, we ought to do what he says. And this is what he's commanded us to do, you know, and we're to exemplify Christ. And that's the second point that I'd really like to make. In verse 34, the second half of 34 says, even as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. Our love is to be as is Jesus's love. And something that popped out to me as I'm thinking through this passage and thinking through this, actually this whole block of scripture, look at the wording here. Even as I have loved you, you also have loved one another. Christ is our standard, making this the new commandment. Therefore, the way we exhibit our love to one another ought to be as Christ exhibited his love for us, his love for you, his love for me. In other words, friends, Jesus' love is so great for us and his obedience so true to the Father that he gave his only life. Jesus lived by example, and when we live out this radical love, we exemplify Christ. It's this love that's actually at the core of the gospel. When we think about it, Christ's love for us is completely infinite, which blows my mind. That means it's unending. There is no end in sight. There is nothing that can separate you from the love of Christ Jesus. Nothing. That's unbelievable. And while we can never love infinitely, like I said before, we can never reach that standard that of perfection when it comes to love. That doesn't mean it not be that shouldn't be our standard. It's to the contrary, actually, that love has love has to serve as our example. And the love of Christ is what leads us into that example. Love as Christ loves. You know, Rabbi Zacharias, he passed a few days ago now, and he was a huge part of my life. And it was Can Man Live Without God that made me think critically about the Christian worldview for the first time, and ultimately formed cracks and fissures in my atheistic worldview. He said this, he says, love is a commitment that will be tested in the most vulnerable areas of spirituality, a commitment that will force you to make some very difficult choices. It's a commitment that demands that you deal with your lust, your greed, your pride, your power, your desire to control, your temper, your patience, and every area of temptation that the Bible clearly talks about. It demands the quality of commitment that Jesus demonstrated in his relationship to us. So in loving like Jesus loved us, we're not only being obedient, but we're modeling Jesus. But there's more, and this is the last point, just the last 2 minutes, guys. Hang in there with me. Verse 35 says, by this all men will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. If love is a distinguishing mark of a Christian given to us by Christ, as Schaeffer says, how we love each other will ultimately reflect on Jesus of Nazareth. And when we live this way, we're living as Christ commanded us and modeling it for us. We're copying Jesus. And not only are we copying Jesus, but while we do it, not only is it good, that this love that we're talking about will unify us. It'll bring us together. And I feel like that's kind of like what we need right now. We need to be unified. You know, when I look ahead to John 17 and Jesus' high priestly prayer, we see him praying for this unity. I do not ask on behalf of those alone, but those also who believe in me through their word, that they may all be one. even as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be in us. And then listen, this blows my mind. So that the world may believe that you sent me. You see, here's Jesus praying for unity among the saints, a unity finding its footing in love. This love brings us together. And in that, others take notice. It serves as a witness. Jesus says that the world may believe that you sent me. What Jesus is saying here is that we're commanded to love each other sacrificially, and in doing so, that love ought to unite us as a people, and even more, the world is going to pass judgment on us depending on how well we do this. We bear witness to the world in how we love one another, and when we go back to verse 35 in the passage that we've been mainly talking about, all men will know that you are my disciples. You see, friends, we're ambassadors for Christ. We represent him here and now, and culture is observing us. The world is watching us, looking on as we respond to the circumstances of the culture that we're in currently right now. And if they see us unified through self-sacrificial love, they'll be drawn to it, and they'll be changed. I believe it in my heart that they'll be changed forever. In John 15, 8 and 9, Jesus reiterates this. He says, my Father is glorified by this, that you bear much fruit and so prove to be my disciples. Just as the Father has loved me, I have also loved you. Abide in my love. You see, the loving is what distinguishes the Christian. And I think this is what Greg sometimes means when he says, give them heaven. We're to be out in the world making a case. Yes, making a case for the Christian worldview, sitting at the marketplace of ideas. But if it's not done out of love, we're just a clanging cymbal. So at this time in our history, in this time in our culture, this present time that we find ourselves, can I encourage you, friends, get out there and love somebody. That's how we can respond to everything that's going on. And don't love them for any other reason than that they are made special and unique in the image of God. This is John Noyes for Stand to Reason. I'll be right back with some callers.
We have some really exciting news. We have a new name for our student apologetics conferences. At Stand to Reason, we talk a lot about reality. As a result, we're in the habit of saying Christianity is the best explanation of the way things are. That is, Christianity matches up with the way the world really is, with reality. It makes sense of the origin and design of the universe and life, the existence of objective truth and morality, the purpose, meaning, and value of human experience, the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, and the existential longing of every human heart. In other words, we have reality on our side. That's why we've decided to call our events, drumroll please, STR's Reality Conference. Unfortunately, many students are under the impression that Christianity is make-believe for grown-ups. At our apologetic student conferences, we're pushing back by using our greatest ally, reality. Christianity isn't a made-up story divorced from reality. It is the true story of reality. So join us at one of our two-day reality conferences in California, Washington, Minnesota, or Texas. Discover why we believe Christianity is the best explanation of the way things are by visiting realityapologetics.com and registering today.
You know, if you've gained anything from listening to Stand to Reason, I'd really be thrilled to hear it from you. I love to take your questions, of course, but I also want your feedback. So here's what you can do. Head over to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a rating and a review. That kind of thing really helps us to get the word out so more ambassadors for Christ can find the show and become equipped to stand confidently. And you never know, I might just give you a shout out on the air to show you my appreciation for your positive review. I value you as a faithful listener. I look forward to reading what you think about the show. Thanks.
And hello, guys. We are back after our first break. This is John Noyes for Stand to Reason. And we're going to dive into some of your calls right now. I'm really excited to meet you guys here, even if it's just via phone. I'm going to go, I think it's Tom is our first caller in California. Is that right?
Yes.
Hey, Tom, how's it going, man?
It's going good.
Yeah. Where in California you live in?
Central Coast in a town called Salinas, about an hour south of San Jose.
Yeah, Salinas. Awesome, man. And how are you holding up there in this quarantine?
We're making it.
That seems the response everybody does. Now, everybody gives, rather. Now, you've got a question regarding the moral argument.
Correct.
What would it be?
Well, I'm talking with an atheist friend, and I chose that approach, and I'm well aware of how it works. And we got to the predictable point where the atheist, my friend, naturally tosses out evolution as how we, as humans, ground objective morals. And then I instinctively went for the common reaction on the theist part, which is to point out examples of times in history or countries, even right now as we speak, that do things we would find abhorrent, like Jim Crow laws or gay bashing or throwing Jews into gas chambers, in order to show that evolution cannot be used as an adjudicator between them, since obviously evolution gave them their moral code. So obviously it implies a code outside, a higher standard scoring card. And so that was the primrose path I was trying to lead him on. But he came up with a good pushback that I had never heard before, and I've never heard Greg or any other apologist try this pushback. You ready?
I'm ready, I hope. Well, we'll see after you give it to me.
Okay. So when I went to give the common usual examples, let's say my friend and I agreed murder of innocent people is wrong, and that's objective. He actually agreed with objective moral, standards. And so we went to the example of Nazi Germany and Jim Crow laws, for example, racism. And he said, wait a second, Tom. You're looking at the outliers. You're looking at a small sampling of people at a certain time and not the world as a whole. When he's using the word evolution, he doesn't mean to look at a fluke outlier. Yeah, of course, there's always some, persons that are going to think murder of innocent people or racism is correct, but not if you took the pulse of, let's say, in Germany in 1939, if you'd have taken the pulse of the entire Europe or all the world, the whole world would have obviously not said murder of Jews in gas chambers was good. So therefore, my examples to him are going, just rubbing right off. They're not sticking. So how do we answer that?
So let me see if I just understood what you said. He's arguing basically that if the whole world had thought gassing Jews, for example, was acceptable, we would have done it.
Then it would be an objective moral standard, which makes no sense because obviously he would stand up and wave his fist and say, no, no, the whole world's wrong and I'm right. I get it. And I was going to try and lead him. I tried that. I predicted your theist comeback and I said, well, what if the whole world voted it was right? And he says, come on, Tom, seriously, let's be serious. And I had to admit, let's be honest, if you did take a vote of the entire world, there's no way that that's going to be a realistic vote. And so it, again, didn't stick to him. And I think you would be the first to agree that if we could theoretically poll the whole world, nope, they're not going to come back with a vote to the affirmative. So in his mind's eyes, once you get that theoretical vote, that becomes the objective and not measuring individual isolated fluke outliers.
Yeah, right. But it seems to me like what he's appealing to isn't objective morality, because he's still saying that it's decided upon by the popular vote. And because he's saying,
correct,
well,
so
he doesn't believe in objective morality.
Well, he would say that once the whole world votes on it, that by definition becomes objective, is I guess what he's going to try and say.
But that's not objective morality, though. You know what I mean? That's the same thing as saying social contract.
Go ahead.
Go on. No, you're good.
I would have to give him an example of some objective moral standard that theoretically the whole world would vote on, but I can't think of it. Maybe slavery at one time was not an issue, slavery of blacks. There could have been a time in the 1700s where perhaps the whole world would have seen it as innocuous. Maybe that would fly as an example.
Yeah, I think, I don't think you have to give him an example. I think you're trying to take on too much here, Tom. I don't think you need to give him an example. I think that he's the one that's claiming objective morality exists. And that means he's got to give you an example of how what an objective moral standard would be on his worldview. I would come back at it from talking to your friends. I would just say, well, you know, we all know that rape, for example, is wrong. We all know it. Now, there's some cultures that it's not always wrong, but that doesn't make
there,
it right.
Again, you're just measuring an outlier. If he would say, if you voted on the whole world, let's be honest, they would not say rape is benign or good.
Yeah, but that's not, see, now he's just talking about social contract theories. Why is he using the whole world as his standard as opposed to just half the world?
Because that is the definition of evolution. You can always find flukes, but when you look at the whole, that is what defines evolution, not the fluke outliers.
But evolution doesn't give us this. He's not drawing this from his evolution, from his natural selection. I mean, he's drawing this, he's saying that because number one, it's a hypothetical, right? Because the whole world thinks that rape or murder or whatever you say is wrong, it's wrong. Why is it 51% of the world? Is it 51% of the world? Is it not 75% of the world? Like, where is it? Because he's saying, oh, well, my evolutionary perspective. Well, I don't see how he gets that from his evolution. Does that make sense? He's pulling this stuff out of thin air.
It makes sense if we can think of something that truly was a 51, 49, or 75 kind of thing. But all the examples that, let's say, Greg Kokel gives typically are Jim Crow laws and Germany, which we can both agree that, come on, if you'd have taken a vote in the world, it would have been 99.9-1. I mean, you're looking at fluke outliers, so it seems to be poor examples.
Yeah, no, according to his definition, though. So I think you're letting, like I said, I think you're letting him get away with way too much here. And I think that you're trying to carry too much burden. I want to know why is he saying that we have to survey the whole world to do this? Like, why is this hypothetical? Why can't it be, say the United States? Why can't it be that? Why can't it be my neighborhood? Or why can't it be my house? You know, so basically what he's doing is he's pulling stuff out from thin air and making up his own understanding. He's not drawing from his evolutionary perspective on this. At least I don't understand how.
Well, maybe if we use the Darwin with the Galapagos Islands, he studied singular islands. He didn't go the world over looking at beaks everywhere. He just made note between two different competing islands. So, yeah, I can see your point. So,
well, and of course, like, why didn't he go across the world studying every single beak of every single bird?
Mm-hmm.
Well, because it would be impossible.
Yeah, okay, I hear you. Can you know I tell I mean? You his second? Can I tell you his second
yeah.
objection that I've also? Okay, the next one he moved on to was in the case of, let's say, Nazi Germany. Even if we accept that we can study a fluke outlier, that his opinion was that deep down inside, Hitler, the Nazi soldiers, they all really knew it was wrong, but they just did it anyway. So therefore, there's no need for an adjudicator. If both sides are saying it's wrong, but the other side is merely saying, I'm going to do it anyways. But notice in each case, they're saying, yeah, what I'm doing is wrong, but I'm going to rape anyways, or I'm going to murder anyways. So there's no need for an adjudicator if both sides have said this is wrong.
Yeah, but that goes against even the people that he would follow, like a Richard Dawkins, who says that there is no morality. You know, it's blind, pitiless indifference out there. And that's somebody who's, I think, at least being honest with their evolutionary perspective, and at least appealing to, you can't appeal to an objective morality in that sense. What it seems to me is that he's basically just using a social contract theory, what he wants to use is a hypothetical world social contract theory. But number one, it's an impossible standard, because we can't possibly survey every single person. But at the same time, I know it's something that was really interesting that you just said is that he thinks that the Nazis knew it was wrong, even though they did it anyway. How is he basing that? According to the some of the Nuremberg trials, man, not every Nazi knew it was wrong.
Yeah, they claimed innocence, and the Jews had it coming to them, and they still, they pounded the anti-Semitic gavel till they died. Yeah.
I mean, we still see remnants of that today, you know, and also people tend not to do things that they know are wrong. They tend not to do that. I mean, they might do things that are wrong, but there's a cognitive disconnect there, I think, when people pursue,
unless you're pathological. Yeah.
Unless you're a sociopath or something, you know, I mean, it's just not, that's just not the way that we're made. Why? Now that's the question that he has to answer. Why was there? Okay. So they knew it was wrong in their conscience. Okay. Where'd their conscience come from and why did they think it's wrong?
Okay.
Like, what do you mean wrong? You know, because what they surveyed every human on the planet and statistically came to an understanding that this is wrong. By a 51% vote.
I see. So he smuggled in morality through the back door. I hear you. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's definitely not coming from his atheism. I don't think. I mean, I think that's one of the things that we have. We have friends in Richard Dawkins and these people in what they say about morality, at least, where when they come to their conclusions based on naturalism, and then they bump into reality, right? So they'll claim that God is the most unpleasant character in all of fiction is what Dawkins says. But then at the same time, they'll say that God is wrong. And it's not because of their evolution they're saying that. It goes in the face of their evolution, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Does that do it for you, Tom?
Thank you very much.
Oh, man, thank you so much. Be safe out there, and thanks for calling.
Okay.
All right. That was a fantastic question. I love talking moral argument, especially in the context of being in a relational conversation with somebody, because that means that Tom is out there contending for the faith. And I hope that he finds listening ears and has success in that conversation. Next, I'd love to go to Joe in Washington, D.C. Joe, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing so good. Man, where are you in Washington, D.C.?
I'm just outside of D.C. in a little town called Fairfax.
Yeah, I lived in D.C. for, 10 years. So I went to American University.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then lived in Bethesda and all over D.C.
Yeah, it's a beautiful little area. I've grown up and lived here my whole life, so it's a fantastic little place to live in.
It is, man. And what can we do for you? What's your question today?
Well, I wanted to ask you a question, but I was wondering if I could kind of comment a little bit on what Tom said. Maybe this could just offer my thoughts. Maybe that would help out with this question.
Uh-oh, you're going off the radar here, man. Absolutely.
Okay. I appreciate that, man. But from what Tom said with his friend, I'm not sure if this would give a full and complete answer in response to the atheist that he was talking with. But I think Robbie Zacharias, God bless him now that he's with the Lord, he kind of answered the question for this particular person pretty adequately, I think. And it was kind of in his lecture, Can Man Live Without God? And he was kind of saying that, if we're going to vote on what's necessary, then that he would have to assume that certain things are wrong as opposed to certain things being right. But the question that you have to, but I think the question you have to ask yourself is, why is it wrong? But at the same time, if an atheist brings about evil, it's a logical outworking of whatever it is the atheist believes. So if naturalism is true, then the Nazis killing people, even if people vote on it, it's still a logical outworking because you don't have a moral foundation for what morality actually is. So that's not to say that atheists are immoral people. That just says that they don't have a basis. It's not an amoral basis. It's an immoral basis. So I think that might kind of help a little bit in that Tom there.
I think that's a good point, you know. So thanks for that. And what's your question that you're calling with us about?
Well, I feel this is relating to your talk, so I feel a little bit like I'm giving you a difficult question in relationship to what you said. But I wanted to talk about how you were talking about how it's important for us to love each other and go out and love others, which is our number one priority. And I think that's relatively easy from a standpoint of us being Christians and being able to show love to each other because we have a transformed life. But I think it could be also difficult in times like this because we all know what's going on over in Minneapolis and what's going across the country in response to that. But I've been talking with a couple of people who are my friends, mostly online, and they support a lot of the riots and a lot of the violence that's going on there. So I don't mean to make this talk so much and be kind of like crass since I'm talking more about the violent tactic. But a lot of people will say nonviolence has not worked in the past, even if Martin Luther King stood for nonviolence. And even though Gandhi said that it's wrong for you to think that people who are nonviolent are weak, it seems like there are still people out there that still openly advocate for expressing violence when injustices are done. So,
sure.
I think my question would be then, how can we as Christians respond to that very deep-rooted anger and almost kind of violent mindset that people put out there, in which if we need to use this means to get our freedom and our treatment as equals, how can we respond to people who bring about that? Because there were a lot of peaceful protesters, and I even saw video clips from the news basically saying, showing that there were peaceful protesters. They were arrested, but they actually attempted to make friends with the police.
Yeah,
and and I think that's admirable. I think it's more hard to kind of convey that kind of love and respect to people who have that more hostile mentality. So how can
I think I get what you're saying, and you bring up a really difficult topic. And I think one of the main things that we got to do at this point is we got to not make judgments while everyone's, you know, so worked up and while we don't have all the information, especially at this moment. And I think people oftentimes we're led oftentimes by the media. And the media might help us jump to some conclusions. And I think it's important for us, you know, so it's important for us as ambassadors to be careful and to be wise during this time, especially right now, just a few days after a major event happens. I think it's important that we wait for everything to come in. And then it's important for us to come alongside one another. So you might not be able to change your friend's view of the type of protesting, whether it be violent or nonviolent. But what we are responsible for doing is representing Jesus of Nazareth on this earth right here and now. So we can move towards that person, not validating them, maybe not saying that what they're saying is appropriate or right, but maybe go towards them by asking questions, being tactful as we engage them. You know, try to maybe get to better understand their thinking, you know, help them educate you on why they feel the way that they do. I have a feeling that it might be led by, by anger, frustration, and deep seated hurt. You know, and I think that what we can do, like I said before, is we can walk alongside these people and love them, even in the midst of us disagreeing with them. And it doesn't mean that we have to try to prove them wrong and say, you know, nonviolence is the way to go. Cause I think that we need to,
absolutely,
you know, and what I'm finding right now in my life personally is I'm just really trying to work on my listening skills. like, I'm just really trying to be an active listener, especially to the people that I disagree with, especially the people who are really expressing hurt and anger. I'm just trying to listen to them. I'm not trying to, like I said before, I think that, you know, I think oftentimes in these conversations, especially when we jump out of the gate so quick, we offer more heat than light and we throw gas on a fire that you don't need to do. So that would be kind of my advice. I mean, I don't have an apologetic necessarily for you to show you that nonviolence is the way. I haven't really thought of it, you know, but I think honest conversation and just walking alongside the person, listening to what they have to say and maybe asking, tactical questions, you know, well, how you say nonviolence has never worked. What do you mean? You know, can you give me some examples of when nonviolence has failed and violence was the only way, you know, and then maybe...
I've heard a couple of responses from them and they've said kind of like, well, these people have used nonviolent tactics, like Gandhi and Dr. Martin Luther King have used nonviolent tactics, and yet the authorities still responded with violence in response to them.
Sure.
So therefore we should just abandon this idea that basically showing nonviolence means that we'll become successful, because obviously we don't see that.
Yeah. I go back to the comment that we're so we're called to live a certain way. Like, you know, we have a prescription for our life. And I think all we can do is really control that, right? The Holy Spirit is responsible for redeeming and saving hearts and minds. Mm-hmm. And we can trust God to do that. He'll do his part if we do ours. So I think right now, as Greg would say, it's just a lot of gardening. I think we need to be out there doing some gardening, talking to our friends, certainly our family who disagree with I'm the only Christian in my side of the family, right? You know, my wife and my kids are Christian, but you know, my mom, my brother and my sister are not. And we differ on so many different issues. But I find that the most successful conversations I have in times of turmoil, are the ones that I move into it slowly, cautiously, with an open mind, not a goal. So I'm not trying to win an argument. I'm just trying to put I'm just trying to put a stone in their shoe, get them something to think about. And right now might not be the best time to do that with your friend. Right now might not be the time to talk about violence or nonviolence, because like I said, the facts just aren't in, you know, and I think it's important and it's more beneficial to be careful and wise at this point. I hope that helps.
That does help. I appreciate that.
Awesome, Joe. Well, I really appreciate you calling us today. And
thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, man. And I think actually right now is going to be a good time to take our second break. And I'm John Noyes. This is Stand to Reason. I'll be back with you in like 90 seconds.
Did you know Stand to Reason has a YouTube channel? We release a new video each Monday on the topics you care about. Through short, engaging videos, our speakers train you on tactics, offer apologetics tips, answer common theology questions, and address big issues in the world today. Join tens of thousands of other subscribers so you can stay up to date when we release a new video. Just go to youtube.com and search STR Videos, all one word, and hit the subscribe button. That's STR Videos. Take advantage of this free resource to help you stay informed, encouraged, and equipped as you share your worldview with others.
Have you ever wondered how Stand to Reason is able to produce fresh, accessible, and relevant content each week? As a nonprofit ministry, we rely on generous supporters in order to provide the tools and tactics you need to be an effective ambassador for Christ. If you've benefited from this podcast or any of our donor-provided resources, including apps, blog posts, articles, or short videos, consider making a financial contribution to Stand to Reason today. When you visit str.org/donate, you'll find a newly renovated transaction page that makes it easier than ever to show your financial support. It has been an honor providing you with a host of free resources over the past 25 years to help you give voice to the Christian worldview. Please help us to continue on into the next 25 years by making a gift today at str.org/donate.
Hello, this is not Greg Kokel. If you're expecting to hear his voice here at Stand to Reason, I am so sorry, but I am John Noyes. I am a speaker and outreach coordinator for Stand to Reason, and I've been privileged to cover for Greg while he's on vacation today, and we've been talking about an awful lot. You know, at the beginning of the show, if you've been tracking with us, I got the opportunity to share with you just some thoughts about what we're called to, you know, Christian love and what it means to love like Jesus. And that's the new commandment that Jesus gave. And during this time, you know, I only have a couple more minutes with you guys. I'd like to share a few things. But first, I really want to point out something new that Stand to Reason is doing right now. It's called Red Pen Logic with Mr. B. And that Mr. B is the guy that you all love, Tim Barnett, one of our speakers, and you guys should really check it out on YouTube. If you YouTube and Google Red Pen Logic, it'll pop up. Make sure you hit the like, but also make sure you hit the subscribe button. And in these short little videos, they're super creative and really well done. Tim picks apart bad ideas in a really fun and engaging way. And I can't really describe it. You're going to have to go on and watch one for yourself. But I promise you will not be disappointed. This is something that Tim does very well with our team at Stand to Reason. So make sure you look out for it on the website. Make sure you go to the YouTube channel and subscribe. And make sure you keep an eye out on Facebook and Twitter for new ones that are coming out, because you don't want to miss that. And on the same vein, actually, I don't know if you guys know this, but we have a new student conference name, and it's STR's Reality Student Apologetics Conference. And you can go to realityapologetics.com. That's realityapologetics.com. And you can find out what we're up to, where we're going next. And the whole schedule of speakers is up there, and it's a really interesting theme, and I'm not going to tell you what it is because you got to go to the website to check it out this year. It's the Reality Apologetics Conference, and you don't want to miss it. And in that same vein, we are actually looking for a new church to host the conference in the South or Southeast in 2021. So if you find yourself listening to this right now, and you are a pastor or on staff or attend a fairly large church, make sure you get in touch with us, and you can email Danielle, and I'm going to spell this one for you. It's DAWNIELLE at str.org. And she'll get you all the information that you need. We would love to partner with you and your church and bring this conference to the South or Southeast. It's amazing. These conferences blow me away every time I go. Thousands of students show up in force to get equipped and leave there, not just encouraged, not just on a mountain high, but they actually, I think they become better ambassadors and are able to be deployed into the culture. So with that, guys, you know, the first, you know, maybe 25 minutes I spent talking about the radical love of Jesus and how I think that as we put on Jesus, as we find our strength in the gospel and what Jesus did for us, and we let him serve as example, we move towards the culture in love and amazing things happen, you know, and I thought that I'd share something that goes along with love and just something that has, again, been on my heart, and I'll do the best I can in the next, 4 minutes here. I just want to let you know, guys, I'm not praying for all this stuff to stop. And that might sound harsh. That might not sound realistic. But I want to let you know I'm praying for something else. I think something that's more important. You know, in Romans 5:3, we read that we should exalt in our tribulation. And again, being the skeptic that I am, I ask the question, why? You know, I'm like a little kid in that. Well, I think the answer is because as Paul continues in Romans 5, he says tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance proving character, and proving character hope. And hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out within our hearts through the Holy Spirit who's been given to us. You know, I think in these three verses, Paul provides a really clear and great insight into the way God allows suffering in our lives, those tribulations, to weigh heavy but transform us. He describes actually, I think, a chain of transformation consisting of four links. And if you guys can just track with me really quickly here, you know, I'll, let me give you the ultimate takeaway just in case I don't get there. You know, suffering is necessary for the Christian life because it leads to hope that transcends our current circumstances and releases the love of God into our lives. You see, the first link in our chain is tribulation, and this is what Paul says, right? So suffering during tribulation, it's simply unavoidable in a fallen world, but it has a purpose. You know, tribulation produces perseverance, and that's that second link that Paul refers to. So what happens is we're trusting God while we're enduring the hard things of life, and eventually that trusting God through those hard things results in a stubborn determination to finish the race. You know, we become better equipped to live in this fallen, broken world, but we also keep in mind we don't persevere through things that are easy, right? We persevere through things that are by definition tough. We persevere through suffering. Without suffering, there's nothing to endure, and suffering changes us. It teaches us tenacity, is what I'd say. You know, and then the third link in our chain connects perseverance to character. You know, proven character is the quality of a person who's been tested and has passed the test. A person with proven character is the sturdy veteran. You know, I think of military terms. You know, the person who has character is that veteran who's been through it. It's not the recruit who's green and doesn't know what to do or where to go. It's someone who's been through the battle and he's still standing. And then the last link is going to be hope. And it's that hope of Christ. It's the hope of the gospel that we're left with, friends. So keep in mind that the tribulation, the suffering that we endure in our life, it's not for naught. Jesus loves you, and he's using it to transform you, to make you better equipped for heaven ultimately, guys. So, hey, if you've been tracking with us, this is John Noyes for Stand to Reason. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for tuning in.